Support comes from Empower Missouri, working to fight poverty and secure basic human needs and equal justice through coalition building and advocacy. Information about involvement at empowermissouri.org/action.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The Missouri legislature is roughly halfway done with its only constitutional obligation of this session, passing a budget for the upcoming fiscal year. The Missouri House sent its nearly $48 billion budget over to the Senate last week, where it likely will face changes. On this episode of Politically Speaking, Democratic Representative Betsy Fogel joins the show. Fogel is the top Democrat on the budget committee. She talks about the House budget, including where she wants to see changes and how the federal government could drastically affect the makeup of the budget. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oratory over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, State House and Politics reporter Sarah Kellogg. Joining us in St. Louis, he is St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And across from me, she is the representative for the 135th District in the Missouri House of Representatives.
Betsy Fogel, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming back to the show. I know it's been a minute since you've been on the show. Kind of remind our voters about your district and who you represent.
I have represented House District 135 for the last 5 years up here in the Missouri State Legislature. I represent the northeast quadrant of the city of Springfield. So if you're familiar with the Queen City, everything that falls north and east of Mercy Hospital to the city limits, both directions. Born and raised in Springfield and really just been the opportunity of a lifetime to represent my hometown up here in the Capitol.
Springfield now has 3 Democratic representatives. I know when you were elected, you were the second from the city. You've since added on. What do you believe has kind of caused this shift over the last couple of election cycles?
I think, you know, a lot of things, just kind of shifting dynamics in Springfield. It is the third largest city in the state. And I think people are attracted to move to the city because we have kind of the perfect blend of having enough stuff to do that we're never bored, but small enough to where you really feel like you can make a difference, which I love. I think Springfield is unique in that our colleagues across the aisle work really well together. Both Republicans and Democrats, all of us recognize that Springfield is truly a 50-50 district or a 50-50 city, which means bipartisan legislation and bipartisan effort is the way to go. We have 3 Democrats now elected in Springfield, as you mentioned, and I think a large part of that is attributed to the work that we do on the campaign side. I know my campaign knocked 40,000 doors this cycle. I won my first election by a very narrow margin, and then Stephanie Hine flipped her district 2 years later, and we wouldn't have done that had we not knocked so many doors and worked so hard on the campaign side.
And you mentioned Springfield being a 50-50 city. I believe most, if not all, the city of Springfield is in the 30th senatorial district. We can't predict the future here on Politically Speaking, but do you think that will be the most competitive state legislative race in the state of Missouri next year?
I do. Senate District 30 has been represented by Senator Lincoln Huff, who has done an incredible job of bringing home infrastructure investments, investments in our public schools. Springfield is home to the largest public school district in the state, and Senator Lincoln Huff has done a fantastic job of representing the interests of our community. I think as we look to 2026, you're exactly right, Jason. There are going to be a lot of eyes on what happens in that senatorial race, a lot of money spent, and a lot of work from both sides of the aisle. And I know Republicans plan to keep it Republican, and Democrats want to make it the next Democratic senator seat and bring a little bit more balance to the Missouri State Senate.
You serve as the ranking member on the House Budget Committee. So let's get into the budget because the House just passed that. We're recording this on Monday, April 7th. But what do you make of the House version of the budget that you have sent over to the Senate?
So I think this is my fifth year in playing a relatively small role in crafting a very large budget. And I think what is different about this year to me as a member of the budget committee is just the process of which we crafted the budget. My first 4 years, we went back and forth kind of on how closely we were going to go through each line item, on if we were going to go to conference committee. I know that's kind of all in the weeds, but from a procedural perspective, I really think things couldn't have gone better this year, with the exception of some of the IT frustrations with movers, which again is kind of an in the weeds term. But outside of that, I think the chairman and I worked really well together. I appreciate and respect him so much for the role that he's played, for the communication he's had with the minority party. Not all members of the majority feel compelled to work so well with their minority counterparts. Of course, there are things in the budget that I find frustrating, and I'm sure we'll get to some of those today. But it was a really good few months in terms of working across the aisle, in terms of the majority party respecting what the minority party wanted to see in the budget, and House Democrats were able to bring home some significant dollars to our districts, and was really proud of my entire team, half of which had never served on budget before, but got into the room, pulled up their sleeves. We spent hundreds of hours in that budget room and in the appropriations office trying to understand the, you know, just under $50 billion budget. And I think House Democrats just did a really great job of being a part of the process. And I'm just incredibly happy with how it all went.
The legislature is coming off a few years of record-breaking budgets due to lots of federal dollars. It appears that era of budget crafting in Jefferson City is over. So how does that kind of play into the entire process of figuring out a financial plan for fiscal year 2026?
Absolutely. So my first 4 years, I had the pleasure of serving under a federal administration that saw fit to make investments in our state through a lot of the federal stimulus dollars that, you know, flowed through the legislature that we were then able to turn around and push out to communities. I think the tenor and temperament of the new administration under President Trump is a completely different one, in that instead of making investments in Missouri, the headlines that we see, the conversations that we have, and the questions that we have to ask of our departments are, what is going to happen if Medicaid reimbursement rates change? What is going to happen if the federal assistance freeze, if that hadn't been ruled unconstitutional by the courts? I have never been busier in this building than the day that the federal assistance freeze came down, and I had constituents calling, coming by the office, advocacy groups that were scared, wondering what they were going to have to do, if they were going to have to close their doors, if they were going to have to stop being able to provide services. And of course, we know that the court stepped in, but it is a completely different environment trying to craft a thoughtful and fiscally responsible budget when almost weekly we're hearing this new idea from the Trump administration that would leave a very big, insignificant hole in our budget, versus my first 4 years when the administration saw fit to be supporting and making investments in the state.
You know, talking about federal concerns, you know, there's questions about, you know, you said Medicaid reimbursement. So you're mentioning kind of federal concerns of kind of what the Trump administration is doing, either through, you know, federal dollars economically. Are there major concerns about Medicaid as far as matching Medicaid reimbursements, which is a huge, huge chunk of the state's budget?
Absolutely. I think everybody who works in the budget space or in the Medicaid space or in the social safety net space recognize the detriment and the harm it will cause our state budget in Missouri if the Trump administration chooses to make some of these in the legislative branch, chooses to make some of these decisions that they're floating. You know, we've seen economic impact statements of $2 billion. Some of the decisions have been up to $7 or $8 billion. When we're talking about under $50 billion budget, a $2 billion hole becomes very massive very quickly. And how do we, as a Missouri State General Assembly, craft a budget looking into the next fiscal year when we don't know if some of those changes are going to happen or when they're going to happen, or are we going to have to come back and deal with the supplemental if those dollars go away? I know there are a lot of constituents back home that are very concerned about what's happening in D.C., constituents who voted for Trump and constituents who didn't, but are concerned about how they pay their bills if their Social Security goes away, concerned about how they get their health care if their Medicaid goes away. And those are real concerns from real people.
I think the concern is that, and this would have to be Congress that changes it, like the Trump administration, I know, is trying to like do a lot of things through executive orders, but If they change the 90-10 federal match that goes to Medicaid expansion states like Missouri to 60-40, unlike other states, Missouri cannot change eligibility. It's in the Constitution. We already went through this with the Missouri Supreme Court. So is that another area of concern, that states like Missouri are kind of handcuffed to continue to retain the expansion population, even if the match basically goes away?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jason. You know, my first year up here, Medicaid expansion was on the ballot with me in August of 2020, and then, you know, became the law of the land and put into our Constitution. The majority party House Republicans chose to not fund it in that first budget year, went to the Missouri Supreme Court, who ruled, as you said, that if we provide Medicaid coverage to one eligible group, we must provide it to all eligible groups. And then subsequent years, the budget team and the General Assembly has chosen to fund those programs, quite frankly, because the Supreme Court told us that we had to. I think that you are exactly right in what does that look like if that Medicaid reimbursement rate changes from 90-10 to 60-40, and those are going to put the budget team and in the legislative branch in a very difficult position, and we're going to have to make some tough decisions about what are we going to fund and what are we not going to fund. You know, for me, my background is in public health. I worked at a federally qualified health center for 7 years prior to being elected for office. And I think that, and I stand by this, Medicaid expansion was the right thing for our state. We could not have predicted that we would have a president come in who would be kind of lead ballooning some of these ideas that would, in my opinion, leave dramatic and negative impacts on Missourians. And I'm hoping that those ideas don't become reality, which is what we've seen in a lot of the other, in my opinion, negative and poor ideas coming out of the Trump administration.
Obviously, it's very hard to deal in hypotheticals. And Representative Deaton, who, as you said, is the budget chair on the House side for Republicans, you know, he said obviously it's something he's thinking about, but he can't really worry too much about it right now because it hasn't happened. Do you feel like the legislature is putting enough kind of thought of emergency plans of what could happen? Or do you think it's kind of a wait and see because there's just so much volatility of what could happen?
From January, in President Trump's swearing in, this is not the first time that the Trump administration has said that they're going to do something and then it hasn't come to fruition, or that he's tried to attempt something through executive order and the courts have ruled it unconstitutional, or that he's tried to fire a bunch of federal employees and then those employees have been welcomed back to work because he, quite frankly, didn't have the power to do so. So I think the chairman said it well. It is impossible to deal in hypotheticals, but it is something we need to be thoughtful about. And our departments need to be intentional about vetting some of these ideas and what are we going to do if some of them come to fruition. But it is very hard to do that when there are ideas coming out of the White House every single day that, in my opinion, aren't properly vetted. And we can't react without some level of thoughtfulness at the state level.
Another area that has kind of had a federal arm on states is related to diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And there's been, you know, there's executive order signed by the president about that. And there's been questions about funding related to that. You know, and Governor Kehoe himself has signed an executive order related to diversity, equity, inclusion, saying it can't be, you know, state dollars can't be spent on that. Are you worried there's a difference between what the federal government thinks is diversity, equity, inclusion versus what the state thinks as far as funding projects and kind of taking federal money for things that maybe will be ruled not eligible in the future?
Yeah, I think, you know, outside of my kind of ethical objection to weaponizing the terms diversity, equity, and inclusion, which, you know, quite frankly, I'm not sure how we got here as a country to where those words became negative ones. But equally concerning, or in addition to that, I think the discrepancy in how we're defining and using those terms is very problematic. I'll give an example. So several times in the state budget, we have earmarked dollars for projects and programs that serve specific groups of people. We have programs that serve specifically young Black men. We have programs that serve specifically women. We have programs that serve specifically Christians. Those in the mind of the majority party who have been very vocal about being anti-DEI, they don't have a problem with, which is ironic because in my mind, those meet the definition outlined in the governor's executive order. And I want to spend a second on that. The governor's executive order says in plain language, the way I read it, I'm not an attorney and I recognize that, but you know, it says you can't spend dollars, I don't have it in front of me, but it says something to the effect of you can't spend, the executive branch can't spend money on programs that provide differential treatment based on race, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. And then the very last line of that executive order says, unless authorized by state or federal law. Well, the budget bills are state law. So whatever we put into the budget, we can spend money on. So to me, when I read that executive order, quite frankly, it doesn't do anything. I feel like this has always been a culture war and not necessarily a practical or pragmatic war. And I think that executive order, in my opinion, kind of highlighted that I don't necessarily know what they're trying to accomplish when we go to the budget and we see all these examples of places that we are doing DEI, active DEI work in the budget. And I applaud that. Different groups have different needs, and that's not something we should shy away from. And then on the back of that, we have this executive order that says, but you can't provide differential treatment, but also we're going to spend $50 million in general revenue going to private schools who only educate children based on their religion or their sexual orientation, which is, again, by definition, differential treatment.
That language was specifically included in the bill that funds higher education. It was the main one that had that, or the only one that had that. Correct me if I'm wrong. I guess thoughts of it specifically going into this bill and not the rest of the budget, because there was a big fight over that a couple of years ago where that language was ultimately stripped out. So the fact that it's on this bill specifically, and I guess your thoughts of it likely remaining as it goes through the budget.
I think it seemed in the chairman's remarks that he's made publicly that the governor's office was who encouraged this language being put in House Bill 3. You know, I don't know if the governor's office, and this is all, you know, speculation just based on my own personal opinion, but I don't know if their thought process was, well, if we put some language in there, then we can put this argument to bed and we can all move on with our lives. I don't know why it was his guidance or his advice to put that language in House Bill 3, especially on the back of an executive order. Did he not think that his executive order accomplished the goal? Why did we have to have that language in one specific House bill? But for House Democrats, I think a majority of us recognize that that language didn't accomplish anything, and we wanted to support the investments made in House Bill 3. And I you know, personally chose to support that budget bill, not because that language was on there, of course, but in spite of that, knowing that that language really, in my opinion, doesn't do anything.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Support comes from Parrot Corporation, a contractor with over four decades of shaping the St. Louis landscape. More at Parrot.com.
And we're back on Politically Speaking. Our guest today is Representative Betsy Fogel, who represents the 135th District of the Missouri House of Representatives. We were talking about the budget. We're going to keep talking about the budget. Just kind of overall, where do you feel the budget is at its best this year?
I think there were a lot of positive investments made in this year's budget cycle. I think one of the areas that House Democrats in specific shone brightest is public-private or public-nonprofit partnerships with our boots on the ground, friends back home who are doing the day-to-day in supporting pathways out of poverty and supporting working families. When you look through what House Democrats were able to accomplish, you see a lot of investments made in nonprofits who are back at home doing the Lord's work, and I'm very proud of that. I'm proud of, you know, some of the things that House Democrats have been fighting for the last few years, we were able to make nominal investments in. We, every year, House Democrats have fought for increased state worker pay, and there are provisions in the budget, though not to the extent that the governor recommended, but we're at least moving forward with that. Fully funding school transportation, something that's really important to me. My nephew was adopted out of the foster care system. And the one person in his life that was stable for those 7 years that he didn't have anyone else looking out for him was his CASA worker. And that was something that, though it's, you know, when you're looking at a $50 billion budget, maybe a few million here or there doesn't seem substantial, but that's something that's really personal to me and my family. And really proud that we were able to get that work done. Lots of investments in infrastructure, public safety. I think overall, there's a lot to be proud of in this budget. And then there are a few areas where House Democrats drastically veer from the majority party's values, and I'm sure we'll get to that in a minute.
We'll get to that actually immediately. Is where do you feel like Democrats wanted to see changes, areas of improvement in the budget?
There are three things that House Democrats have been very vocal from day one when the governor's budget dropped that either we wanted to support or that we were frustrated wasn't included. At the top of the list, not fully funding the foundation formula. I have spoken about that every single opportunity I've had because I think when I look at this budget and the trajectory of this state and of the landscape of public education, not meeting the statutory minimum as outlined by state statute, as overseen by this body, to the tune of $300 million is something I think, quite frankly, we should all be embarrassed and ashamed of. We made promises to our school districts back home based on a formula that we wrote, and the governor stood up and said that he had problems with the foundation formula, but no one seemed to have problems with the foundation formula until now it calls for us spending more money and making more investments in our constituents and in our kids back home. So I think not fully funding the foundation formula is very important to House Democrats. You saw that on the floor. And then marrying that with the fact that for the first time in this state's history, we are going to send $50 million of general revenue to unaccredited schools that do not provide educational opportunities for all children. That is a landscape shift that is very, very scary to me. In my 5 years here, we have seen some of these quote unquote school choice bills pass with 82 votes, 83 votes. We saw every single Republican vote against the House Democrat amendment to strip funding from the voucher program, from the ESA program this year. And that makes me concerned about where the landscape of public education is going to be. A lot of Republicans will get up and say, well, we can have both. We can, you know, have great public schools, and also we can provide school choice through the form of vouchers or open enrollment or whatever to our constituencies back home. However, they didn't choose to do that this year. They chose to take $50 million in general revenue to send to private schools while at the same time not fully funding the foundation formula. Lastly, the thing I'll mention, we were very excited. House Democrats and honestly, House Republicans have been very involved in the child care subsidy conversation over the last year. We had budget hearings where child care providers came in. We had great conversations with the department, with DESE, and where we had bipartisan critique and bipartisan feedback. We were holding the department accountable. We recognized that we needed to get those subsidy payments out the door and that it was providing or creating chaos for our child care providers and for our families back home. The governor stood on the dais in January and promised our child care providers two things. One, they would get paid on enrollment, not attendance. Two, that they would get paid at the beginning of the month and not the end. The budget chairman chose to take those dollars out, about $107 million. House Democrats tried to put those dollars back in, and I think maybe one Republican voted with us on that. And that, to me, is one of, I think, the most glaring disappointment in the version of the budget that we're passing over to the Senate, where I quite frankly think that they're going to fix a lot of those problems.
There's a lot to unpack there. Let's get back to the foundation formula, which you said roughly $300 million short. Can you tell our listeners kind of where that particular shortfall is coming from within the budget? Like how did they get to this number?
Yes, absolutely. So the foundation formula is a very complex, and I would never pretend to be an expert on it, but a very complex formula that tells the state how much per pupil we should be spending on our kids back home. What is an adequate or what is a significant or meaningful investment per child to our local school districts back home? Last year we passed Senate Bill 727, a big education bill. There are some great components in that. There are some not so great components of that. And then also tied into that is the state adequacy target, all very technical. And for listeners back home, might not mean much. But basically, the foundation formula is a number that tells us what is satisfactory, what is a good number to be spending per pupil, per child on our kids back home. And though House Republicans will get up and say we're making the most, you know, we're making historic investments in public education, we're spending $200 million more. That does not change the fact that we have a statutory minimum obligation to spend per child, and we're not meeting that. And the governor and the state of the state, again, stood up and made some comments about how he thinks we need to tweak the foundation formula, and he has convened a task force to look at the foundation formula. All that's okay. That's his prerogative to do, but we shouldn't have underfunded it until we knew what the new path was going to be. And that signals to me that the governor has an intention of spending less per child of making less investments in your kids, in your kids' future, which is something that I'm just not comfortable with.
You know, you mentioned this, the wide-reaching education bill that was passed last year, and that was it passed in the House by the exact number of votes it needed to pass the House. It was a more controversial bill than normally that you see going through that chamber. And do you think that this kind of serves as an omen that the funding that this bill is a large undertaking, because the first year that the House is in theory on the hook for this bill that they passed the following year, there's less coming to the foundation formula? Do you think there's concerns that this bill maybe won't be fully funded in the future if kind of projections in the budget seems to stay the same?
Absolutely. I think, you know, my senator, Senator Lincoln Huff, again, who's been a champion of public schools, has said this publicly, and I share the sentiment that when we pass bills, we're making promises to people. When we pass bills, both the good and the bad, it is our obligation and our moral responsibility to live up to the promises that we made. And I think what you're seeing in year one after that, though, Republicans will get up and say, you know, we're fully funding all components of 727. And there are some great programs in there. There is some language that House Democrats worked on, Senate Democrats worked on. Senate Democrats did a fantastic job of making that bill more palatable and getting some good wins. However, the first year after the passage of that bill, we are not funding the foundation formula again to the tune of $300 million. That is very concerning. And marrying that or coupling that with this move to now privatize education and make it a commodity that all children can access, I think is very, we should all be very hesitant to move forward and to go down a path where we're underfunding kids and sending other kids that to schools that get to pick and choose who they educate. I say this all the time. One of the things that makes this country the greatest country in the entire world is that all of our kids have access to free and quality public education. I wish we'd spend our time in this building talking about how to make that better, not how to water it down and only send some kids to school.
I want to talk about the federal child care subsidies, or just the child care subsidies that Governor Keogh talked about. This was something that the governor said he wanted in the budget. The House took it out. What was kind of your thoughts about the House Republican decision to remove this? And what do you think the impact will be on child care centers?
You know, the chairman's comments in budget committee and then in his public press conference were that he had concerns about the federal funding source, that he had concerns that we would implement this change and that it wouldn't be sustainable. You know, my comment kind of back to that is you can make that argument about any federal dollar right now. We can make that argument about funding Medicaid. We could make that argument about funding our schools. We can make that argument about any dollar that's coming out of Washington, D.C., because on any given day, we're being told that those dollars may or may not come. For me, again, on the backs of a very, very stressful and tenuous time for our child care providers where the state was failing. We were failing as a General Assembly who has oversight of the departments, or at least budgetary oversight. Every time we were told that these child care subsidy payments were going to go out the door by this date, then it would get pushed back a month. It would get pushed back 3 months. We had child care providers who weren't getting paid by the state for a year. What happens if you're a constituent and you don't pay your bill to the state in a year? You get in trouble, but there was no recourse or no opportunity for these child care providers to be made whole. And I had child care providers in Springfield close down because of this. I had foster families who came to me and said, Betsy, I lost my child care subsidy spot because my child care provider can no longer afford to take this gamble on accepting kids on subsidies. We want this child to remain in our home, but I can't afford to not work. What am I supposed to do? And have to put their child back in an overcrowded and underfunded foster care system. These are the real life stories of people who are impacted by the dollar decisions that we make in this building. And we, the governor, stood up on the stage. He didn't say, we're looking at this. He didn't say, this is an idea I have. He said, in 2026, you can expect two things: to be paid at the beginning of the month and not the end, and to be paid on enrollment and not attendance, which are huge wins for our child care community. And then the House chose not to do that.
Well, I want to stay on the topic of Missouri's child welfare system. I've spent the last couple of years reporting on a lot of the inadequacies, especially when it comes to child abuse investigations and also sort of drug rehabilitation efforts. And every time I encounter these inadequacies, it strikes me sort of like being hit in the face with a brick that paying people in the children's division in the mid $40,000 range as a starting salary is not going to be helpful toward improving a lot of these things. And you probably have heard me ask countless questions at press conferences to Republicans and Democrats and to the governor about this topic. I looked at the budget. It doesn't look like they're going to be raising the first draft of the budget raises starting salaries very much. What kind of happened here, with the caveat that Democrats can only do so much and it's the Republicans' responsibility here? But why wasn't that issue addressed in this budget?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I know what you're saying, but I'm going to push back slightly. It's also a Democrat responsibility. I know Republicans have all, you know, pretty much unilateral power in this building, but it's also our responsibility as Democrats to be fighting for the things that we think are most important. I will say in the House, one of the things that's very challenging as a member of the budget committee is the balancing rule that we have to uphold. I cannot go in and make an investment anywhere without cutting from the budget somewhere. And what you saw this year in the House budget process were that House Republicans would come in and they would find areas of lapse, for those who maybe don't live in the budget world, areas in the budget where the departments didn't intend to spend all of the money that they had appropriated to them. And instead of saying, hey, this is a fund source where maybe we could do significant investments or make significant investments, we just cut that lapse from the budget, which I'm not necessarily advocating is a bad thing, but when you're a member of the minority party trying to make significant investments in any portion of the budget, it is very hard to do so when you have to figure out where else to cut in the budget. And so I think when we look at state worker pay kind of across the board, that was something that House Democrats were hoping that we could get back to at least the governor's recommendation. The House cut it by about half. We wanted to at least get to the point where the governor had originally recommended, but finding those dollars in the budget in a way that the chairman was going to be supportive of proved to be very difficult. And to kind of echo some of your sentiments from earlier, you know, in my first 4 years, I myself worked on this as well, trying to do targeted pay increases for our frontline children's division workers. Again, I'll reference watching my nephew go through this and my sister adopt him out of the foster care system. He lived in over 13 different placements in the time that he was in care. And I saw firsthand, my family saw firsthand, the gaps in care that exist. And quite frankly, I think that the General Assembly should be ashamed of the way that we allow children in the foster care system to live. But finding a way of funding that is difficult when you don't have the ability to make the investments that you want. I hope that the Senate chooses to do something. I know Senator Huff in the past himself has had opportunities or has offered amendments to increase Children's Division pay and was told in that hearing room by the director at the time that they didn't need it. And I have never been more mad in this building than on the back of that conversation.
One of the things that I do want to mention is that Governor Kehoe had a proposal that the representative referenced that had you been a state employee for 20 years, you could get up to, I believe, a 10% increase. And now it's been cut in half that you could only get a 5% if you've worked there 10 years. There are people who have worked at the children's division probably for that length of time that would absolutely appreciate that pay increase. The problem is that there's so much turnover in the child welfare space that sort of program will not be useful to something like children's division, where they're, again, the starting salary is $45,000 a year. I'm just a little confused why there isn't more urgency about this. It doesn't seem super controversial. It's not a situation that seems partisan either.
To me, you know, where we place our dollars shows where our priorities are as a state. And the budget, in my mind, is very much a moral document that outlines and highlights where we want to make investments. In my time in the General Assembly, I think the lack of investments made and the lack of urgency surrounding kids in the foster care system is probably the most heartbroken and angry I've been We sit in hearing rooms where we talk about children who are living in hospital rooms because we have no appropriate care. We talk about frontline workers making significantly below any bordering state. We talk about how many kids we have living in the foster care system right now and how Missouri is continually ranks at the bottom of that list. And I don't want to discredit the work that the body has done to make some level of significant investments. And we have had a lot of conversations about the foster care system, but it's not enough. And when you walk around the halls of this building, there isn't a highly paid lobby corps that is pushing this to the top of the list of importance, right? Like, these are vulnerable kids that don't have the money to send high-powered lobbyists to this building to advocate on their behalf. That does not mean by any means that there aren't great people in this building advocating for the right reasons. But how many hours have we talked about video lottery terminals? How many hours have we talked about sports betting? Not that those aren't important issues, but are they more important than the children that we have living in this state who are forgotten every single day? And again, I'll bring you back to my nephew. My sister was his teacher in a public school district down in Springfield. And it just worked out that she had him in class. He had gotten kicked out of his most recent foster care home and had nowhere to go. My sister brought him home and, with a lot of support from our family, chose to adopt him. And that's a success story. But we how many kids do we have that are falling through the cracks that don't have anybody looking out for them? And if they're not our kids as a General Assembly, who do they belong to? If we're not fighting for them, who is? And we have a lot of work to do.
So the budget isn't done. It's out of the House, but it still has to go through the Senate, where a lot of the times you see kind of more money being put in where the House takes some out. Do you anticipate a similar situation this year? Where are you expecting to see kind of changes?
I think Senator Huff, who chairs the Appropriations Committee, of course, in the Senate, has been public about his intention to restore the child care subsidy funds to make investments in the foundation formula. I can't speak for him, but those are the things I think he's been on record as talking about. What you always, or I shouldn't say always, what I've always seen in my tenure here in Jefferson City, the governor creates his recommendations first, shares them at the state of the state. The budget moves over to the House, where we always make cuts, usually to the tune of a few billion. Then we send it over to the Senate, where usually the Senate chooses to make equal, if not more, investments than the governor had recommended. I think I have no reason to think this year will not be any different. I am hopeful that we can have a true conference committee this year. That means, for those at home or who are listening who don't know the budget system well, anytime there's a difference between the House version of the budget and the Senate version of the budget, traditionally we sit in a room and we hammer out those differences, Democrats, Republicans, House, and Senate members. We didn't do that last year, and I think that was a big disservice to the budget, and I'm hopeful that we will be able to do that this year, and I'm hopeful that I'll get to be a part of that process and figure out how to make the most investments and the right investments for our constituents.
It feels like there's just a lot of bills related to tax cuts compared to prior years, at least ones that are getting momentum. You know, as the head of budget for the Dems, you know, are you concerned about these? What are you looking out for? What kind of sticks out as the tax bills you're really keeping an eye on as far as bringing money back next year for next year's budget?
Absolutely. I think for me, when I'm looking at a tax bill or a bill that is that could be conceived as a tax cut, the question I'm always asking is, does this bill mandate or allow the rich to get richer and the poor to get poorer? I think some of the tax cuts that we've seen proposed, capital gains, corporate tax cuts, are those helping the working families in my district where the average income is $38,000 per household? Or are those helping the people who are paying lobbyists in this building to cut their taxes? So finding that balance between making sure that we're giving the right tax cuts to working families back home, but not at the expense of investing in our roads and our bridges and our child welfare system, in our public schools and our firefighters and our law enforcement. We have to have revenue to pay our bills, and I will not allow our schools to continue to be underfunded so corporations don't have to pay their taxes. And when we're looking at all of those bills that are moving. I think the one, Rep. Perkins' bill, the capital gains bill, had a fiscal note at the time that it came out of the House of $1.2 billion. Went over to the Senate, and I think the fiscal note's even larger there. There are some good things put in, circuit tax, circuit breaker tax. But at the end of the day, we got to pay our bills, and we're about, you know, if you read the news last week, you saw that there are a lot of people projecting we hit a recession. What are we going to do if we have those gaps in our budget? How are we going to fund our schools? How are we going to fund your police force, your firefighters, our children's division, all the things that we all care about? So we have to be really, really careful how we do that.
Anything else, Jason? All right, we're good. All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Fogel, for joining us on the show. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is owned by the University of Missouri, St. Louis. You can read all of our coverage, politics and not, at stlpr.org. And Representative Fogel, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
Absolutely. You can find me on my Facebook page, Fogel for Missouri. I am on Twitter/X. Honestly, I don't remember my handle. Anyways, just Google me, Betsy Fogel.
All right. Thank you so much. And until next time, so long.
Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.